Is there a way to tell which patients who are unresponsive will recover?
The global causes of maternal deaths.
Can AI be applied to those who are at risk to develop bipolar disorder or schizophrenia?
And income, education, and cardiovascular disease risk in the United States.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should go first to The Lancet. This notion of who's at risk for cardiovascular disease in the United States.
Despite the fact that the U.S. spends more on healthcare than peer countries, many of our health metrics have actually lagged behind them. This poor health is unevenly distributed. It's been persistent as well. And in fact, there's some concern and data that shows that that gap's increasing. The life expectancy among the richest 1% of Americans is now 10 years higher for both men and women than people in the poorest 1%. These authors sought to take a look at where cardiovascular disease risk cluster. We're talking about diabetes, obesity, cholesterol, high blood pressure, and what's its relationship to both income and to education. They chose to look at 10 different cycles from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey from 1999 to 2018, and they divided it into four groups. The top 20% of earners in the U.S. versus the lower 80%. They divided those into those who had a college education and those that didn't. About 14% of the U.S. population was in the top 20% of income and were college graduates. About 11% were in the top 20% of income but had no college degree. 61% fell into the category where they're in the bottom 80% of income and no college graduate. 14% were in the bottom 80% and had a college degree. And then they looked at congestive heart failure, angina, heart attack, and stroke. For each of those four groups, the individuals in the top 20% of income were much less likely to have any one of those four cardiovascular diseases. It also divided across education status. Now, here's a strange thing that the authors point out. When we look at who decides how we're going to address cardiovascular risk, it's that group that has the best outcome, when in fact, they have the lowest risk.
This is all this selection bias that the elite would be prescribing for everybody else what the right thing is to do. However, I would also point out that if those things are things like exercise, diet, blood pressure control, then those are the right things to do. So tell me about how you might change that.
The individuals that are richest have access to better health care and access to many of the things that lower cardiovascular risk. What's surprising is it's not only based upon income, but it's based upon education. And unfortunately, this particular study doesn't provide any insight into why that is. And so we need to look at that.
I would respectfully suggest that that's going to start with first asking people what messages resonate for them and then employing that type of messaging in order to achieve a better outcome.
Yeah, it's messaging, I agree, and then access as well, Elizabeth. I totally agree.
Let's move to something that resonates for me personally. As you know, in my chaplain role, I spend a little bit not in critical care, but almost all of it in critical care. So this study in Nature Medicine, one of the questions, of course, in critical care medicine is when you have a patient who is essentially unconscious after an acute brain injury, how long are we going to keep them on life support? How can we tell if this person has a chance of really recovering? There's a lot of discussion about this with one recent study suggesting that quite a few people, if you just extended their care longer, would achieve recovery. And that's, of course, a terrible conundrum for the whole healthcare system and for the loved ones. What they did here was they looked at what are called sleep spindles on EEG. So a very non-invasive kind of a thing to do for patients in order to predict who might recover after a traumatic brain injury. Previously, what's been used to try to predict recovery of these behaviorally unresponsive patients who have had an acute brain injury has been what's called task-based electroencephalography, EEG, testing. They look at brain activity and they ask the patient to perform certain things, then they can see that there are brain waves that are associated with a dissociation, this thing called cognitive motor dissociation. So cognitively, they're getting a signal, but motorly, that is, with their skeletal muscles, they can't do anything. So if you can see this cognitive motor dissociation, that's an important predictor. So what these folks did is they said, okay, can we elicit something on this bedside EEG that might help us to look at this idea of who's actually going to recover? They had 226 acutely brain injured patients. They looked at this phenomenon that they term well-formed sleep spindles that were visible on EEG. And they found that those who had those well-formed sleep spindles were more likely to recover with shorter time to their recovery of consciousness and their recovery of independence. These were seen in approximately every third behaviorally unresponsive patient after acute brain injury. So this is possible as something that might help us to discern who's likely to recover when they've had an acute brain injury.
When somebody's not responsive after brain injury, you want to know what residual brain activity that they have that could possibly recover. When someone has cognitive motor dissociation, their brain's working, but they can't translate it into activity. And what these sleep spindles do is they indicate there's activity in the inner brain, and that's seen before cognitive motor dissociation. So if you have both of those, if you have CMD and well-formed sleep spindles, then you're much more likely to recover than if you don't. The reason why this is important is to take that on a routine EEG, and almost all of these individuals have a routine EEG. It's oftentimes present before cognitive motor dissociation is noted as well.
The authors found that inter-rater reliability, which they applied to 45 randomly selected EEGs from 45 unique patients, was excellent. And that's important too, Rick, because we got to be able to have providers look at these things and agree that they're seeing the same thing. And apparently, this is pretty easy to do with this particular pattern.
It is if you have trained specialists. They list one of the limitations in their study is there's insufficient number right now. But once you do, everybody agrees upon what it looks like. So I agree with that.
On to your next one. Let's just mention also in The Lancet.
Global causes of maternal deaths over the last decade from 2009 to 2020. This is data from the World Health Organization Mortality Database and reports from various countries and national and subnational journal articles. Looked at them to identify what the leading causes of maternal deaths are across the globe. It's a terrific study. It's an update of one that was done about a decade ago. Globally, the most common cause of maternal death was hemorrhage. That's about 27% of women who died in childbirth died of hemorrhage, usually in the postpartum period. After that, 23% had indirect obstetric deaths. They had some underlying condition, like, for example, diabetes, and that in addition led to their death. And about 16% died of hypertensive disorders. You were more likely to have a hemorrhagic death if you were delivering in sub-Saharan Africa or Western Asia and Northern Africa, whereas hypertensive disorders were more likely to be the cause of death in Latin America and the Caribbean. These are typically preventable deaths because we have ways of identifying who's at risk, recognizing them, and treating them. It's disappointing that over the last decade, there's not been a significant decline in maternal deaths globally.
And in fact, we've been seeing here in the United States increases in maternal deaths in some populations.
In the US, it's less likely to be due to hemorrhage, more likely to be due to indirect causes, more likely to be due to hypertensive disorders. Abortion as a cause of death is rare, as is, for example, anesthetic causes.
Clearly, this is something that we need to get our arms around and figure out how we're going to implement the strategies that we know already exist to prevent it.
Yep, and so this is improving education, improving antenatal care, better postpartum care as well.
Finally, let's turn to JAMA Psychiatry. And this is the first report I'm familiar with, although they do cite in this particular study previous research where they used AI in order to predict progression to schizophrenia or bipolar disorder among a really big cohort. So, being able to predict progression to these disorders among those who are mentally ill is important because while we don't have the greatest interventions, we do have interventions, and getting somebody into that whole system and providing them support before they progress is going to enable us to discern, hopefully, at some point, what the most effective interventions might be. This study was based in Denmark, and they enrolled all patients aged 15 to 60 years with at least two contacts with the psychiatric service of the Central Denmark region in the time period from January 2013 to November 2016. What they looked at were predictors based on EHR data, including medications, diagnosis, and clinical notes. They had just shy of 25,000 people in this study with just shy of 400,000 outpatient contacts. They created a model that was looking at transition to the first occurrence of either schizophrenia or bipolar disorder with validation after creation of the model with a training set also. The numbers are not great. A sensitivity of 9.3%, a specificity of 96.3%, and a positive predictive value of 13%. Looking at schizophrenia separately, the numbers improved a little bit, and when we broke out bipolar disorder, it really wasn't very good for that. Having said that, I would say that while these are not great numbers, and this is certainly not even remotely ready for prime time, I think as an attempt to try to do this, it's really important. And they integrated something that is fairly unique, and that was the clinical notes and the language that was used in the clinical notes in order to train their model. I think that's something we are going to have to move toward. We've talked before about imaging as low-hanging fruit. It can be digitized really easily, and clinical notes and language are a lot more challenging.
Yeah, so these are conditions that typically emerge when someone's in their late adolescence or their early adulthood. It oftentimes takes years to make a diagnosis of schizophrenia or bipolar. That's because there's a prodromal phase in which the patients really don't meet the full diagnostic criteria, and they have symptoms that overlap with things like anxiety, depression. So they're being treated for these things, and then months and years later, the final diagnosis is made. If you've been following somebody for years, what are the key indicators that could suggest that this is very early schizophrenia or bipolar disorder? And using machine learning applied to electronic medical records allows them to go through years of medical records and search for keywords. It's unique.
This is something that's going to have to be perfected, but I applaud the attempt. And I think that is a very rich source of the kind of information that is ultimately going to end up with a prediction model that's a lot better.
Yeah, it works better for a condition that has many of the same characteristics regardless of the patients, things like schizophrenia. Bipolar is difficult because someone could be manic or depressed or both. But again, this is a first step. It will clearly get better over time.
On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.